Hello, this is Terrence McNally. President Biden has announced that the U.S. will remove all troops from Afghanistan after nearly 20 years, the longest war in our nation's history. And this week you'll hear two interviews from 2009, when we'd been waging the war for 8 years. First, with Matthew Ho, a former Marine who resigned from the Foreign Service rather than participate in the occupation. American families, Ho said at the end of his letter of resignation, must be assured their dead have sacrificed for a worthy purpose, and I have lost confidence such assurances can be made anymore. And second, Malalai Joya, the youngest member elected to the Afghan parliament in 2005. She was expelled in 2007, as she says, for raising her voice. She wrote in The Guardian, "The fact that I was kicked out of office while brutal warlords enjoyed immunity from prosecution for their crimes should tell you all you need to know about the democracy backed by NATO troops." I've got two great guests again today. First, Matthew Ho, the Iraq War vet and Foreign Service officer who recently resigned his post in Afghanistan. American families, Ho said at the end of his letter of resignation, I'm going to quote, must be reassured that their dead have sacrificed for a purpose worthy of futures lost, love vanished, and promised dreams unkept. I have lost confidence that such assurances can be made anymore. And our second guest will be Malalai Joya, the youngest member elected to the Afghan parliament in 2005, but who has since been expelled, as she says, for raising her voice. She wrote in the UK Guardian recently, quote, "The fact that I was kicked out of office while brutal warlords enjoyed immunity from prosecution for their crimes should tell you all you need to know about the democracy backed by NATO troops." On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, and media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Stick around for the next hour, then make it a habit and tell your friends. And if you want to know more about me and my work, check out terrencemcnally.net or email me at temcnally@mac.com. That's one word, temcnally@mac.com, if you want to receive my weekly email telling you who's going to be on and what we're going to talk about. When I decided I wanted to deal with Afghanistan this week, I thought immediately of three possible guests. Malalai Joya and Matthew Ho are two of those. And the third is Anthony Bacevich. He's a retired military man and the author of a wonderful book, The Limits of Power. I'm impressed every time I catch him on TV or in print. He's clear-spoken, principled, he challenges the U.S. to give up empire, and he considers himself a conservative, and I recommend that you check him out. But Matthew Ho is our first guest. He's a former Marine captain with combat experience in Iraq. And he served in uniform at the Pentagon and as a civilian in Iraq and at the State Department. And this summer, he was the senior U.S. civilian in Zabul province, a Taliban hotbed. In September, Ho became the first U.S. official known to resign in protest over the Afghan war. His four-page letter of resignation explains that he became convinced that our war in that country will not only inevitably fail, but that it is fueling the very insurgency that we're trying to defeat. He points out that, quote, next fall, the United States occupation will equal in length the Soviet Union's own physical involvement in Afghanistan. I have doubts and reservations about our current strategy and planned future strategy, but my resignation is based not upon how we are pursuing this war, but why and to what end. In his Salon blog, Glenn Greenwald, writing about Ho's resignation, asks, I'm going to quote Greenwald now, how long are we going to continue to do this? We invade and occupy a country, and then we label as insurgents or even terrorists the people in that country who fight against our invasion and occupation. We then insist that we must remain in order to defeat the insurgents and terrorists, who are largely composed of people whose only cause for fighting is our presence in their country. All the while, we clearly exacerbate the very problem we're allegedly attempting to address, terrorism, by predictably and inevitably increasing anti-American anger and hatred through our occupation, which, no matter the strategy, inevitably entails our killing innocent civilians. The Pentagon's own 2004 report concluded, quote, this is quoting the Pentagon, negative attitudes and the conditions that create them are the underlying sources of threats to America's national security. Direct American intervention in the Muslim world has paradoxically elevated the stature of and the support for Islamic radicals. Welcome, Matthew Ho, to KPFK and Free Forum.
Thank you, Terrence.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. Can you tell us a little bit about your path prior to this difficult decision you made in September? you know, things like, did you always want to be a soldier or a Marine? When did you serve in Iraq? What did you do there? Were you involved in combat? And were you also involved in Reconstruction?
Sure, sure. I joined the Marine Corps in 1998, January of 1998, almost 2.5 years after I graduated college. I had worked in finance for some publishing companies in both Boston and New York City before I decided to join the Marine Corps. And I was in the Marine Corps, both active and reserve, for 10 years. I served in Japan, as well as had time in the Pentagon. I was on the Secretary of Navy's staff. So I got to see senior level decision making in 2002-2004. I left active duty in 2004 and joined the Department of Defense as a U.S. government civilian and went to Iraq to participate in reconstruction programs. Served a year there in Tikrit, Iraq, which is the birthplace of Saddam Hussein, and was there from May 2004 to May 2005. As, like I said, a Department of Defense civilian, I was on a State Department team that was embedded with the U.S. Army there. And so primarily did reconstruction as well as some governance-type work for that year. I came home, went to work as a consultant to the State Department and was on the State Department's Iraq desk for about 4 or 5 months before I had the opportunity to take command of a Marine Corps Reserve Combat Engineer Company. I took that opportunity and deployed with Charlie Company, 4th CEB, was the unit I was with, and we went to back to Iraq in September of 2006 and were there until end of April, beginning of May 2007 in Anbar Province. And during that was primarily combat operations, operations that were part of the surge campaign of fall 2006 through spring 2007.
Wow. So you actually, your combat came very late in terms of your relationship to the Pentagon, the State Department, your Marine service, and so on.
Correct. I mean, my first deployment, while I was not directly involved in combat, of course, the nature of the warfare there, there are IEDs, there's indirect fire, there are small arms engagements that, by necessity, you find yourselves involved in because in a position like I was in where you're out every day working with the local Iraqi population, whether it be Iraqi government officials or Iraqi engineers or the Iraqi military or just Iraqi civilians, you find yourself out every day. So you happen into those circumstances. So the combat end in terms of direct participation, yes, not until my second time there, but indirectly, yes. So plenty of not great things my first time in Iraq.
Yeah, well, because of the Fort Hood incident recently, people are finally paying some attention. They're alarmed about the state of returning soldiers. What was your experience when you returned from Iraq?
You know, my first time, it wasn't so bad. I had lost some Iraqis who had worked for me, some men who had been on my payroll, who had been some of my engineers, who I had developed quite a good relationship with, and I had lost several of them. And you know, coming home was a very stressful year. So coming home, it was difficult. It took a couple months to decompress, but there were no lingering issues, and certainly nothing I would characterize as any type of emotional distress. My second time, however, coming home, I'd had one particular incident that really affected me, and I came home and spent a few months dealing with a bout of you know, what's classified as survivor guilt. I was in a helicopter accident. Four men died. I survived, and I, several months after the accident, was just overwhelmed by this guilt that I had not done more to save those men. And it took me several months of to get through that feeling, and it took really you know, the loss of a relationship as well as several other things in my life to realize that, hey, I need to do something to help myself or it's only going to get worse. But it really was. You hear about these instances where you have this period of blackness or this wave of distress just takes over you, and you read about it and you understand it, but when it happens to you, it's really overwhelming, and it can happen to anybody. I never thought it would happen to me, and it happened to me.
Right, and I'm sure that I never thought it would happen to me is echoed by so many who go over there and return.
Exactly. You receive training on this. The military is pretty good in terms of training. You understand it, particularly at the officer level. You understand what your Marines are going to go through. And I stood in front of my Marines countless times, and my first sergeant did, and my platoon commanders and platoon sergeants did, and we said to our guys, listen, if you're having problems, you need to talk to somebody. It doesn't have to be a chaplain or a psychiatrist or anyone. It could be your wife, girlfriend, your buddy, but you need to talk to somebody. But then when it happens to you, you don't follow your own advice.
I believe it. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Matthew Ho. He's a former Marine Iraq War vet, the experiences we've just been talking about, and he recently resigned his role with the Foreign Service in Afghanistan because he felt he couldn't participate in the ongoing occupation. You can learn more about these issues that we're going to be speaking about today at RethinkAfghanistan.com. RethinkAfghanistan is one word, .com. Let's move ahead so that we can deal with your resignation and the whys and so on. And so tell me, what were you doing in Zabul? What was your assignment? What were the kinds of experiences that I think you were there 5 months at the point at which you resigned that led to your needing to resign?
Sure. Actually, when I first arrived in Afghanistan, I was assigned to Jalalabad, which is a fairly large city, roughly in between the capital of Afghanistan, Kabul, and Peshawar, Pakistan, which is the large city in western Pakistan. And Jalalabad is roughly in between there. It's always been a center of commerce and a center of trade, and because of its position along that trunk road between those two cities. So I was assigned there. I worked with an Army brigade. I was the acting political advisor to the Army brigade commander there. And he was responsible for military operations for the U.S. in four provinces along the Pakistan border. And I spent roughly about 2 months there or so before I was moved down to Zabul province. And down in Zabul province, I was a political advisor on a United States provincial reconstruction team, which is a team of approximately 90 to 100 Americans, and we had about 40 Afghan guards who worked with us as well. We were responsible for doing operations within the province along the lines of reconstruction, development, and governance. So it's everything to trying to get the government to actually serve the people in some capacity that we recognize back here as representative government, and then also to the engineering ends of it, of building roads, putting wells in, building schools, those kinds of things. My specific duties were to work daily with the Afghan provincial governor, who was an appointee of President Karzai. We were co-located with the provincial governor there. Their building was right next to our base. We had just had a simple gate that separated us, so our contact was constant. And during the 3 months or so I was there, it was daily interaction with the Afghan government, as well as getting out and visiting villages and cities within Zabul as often as possible.
Okay, and I've read that you were assigned to research the response to a question asked by Admiral Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and that experience, influenced you.
Sure, yes. That was back when I was in Jalalabad, and Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had visited, and he wanted to know why we were in one particular valley. So it wasn't assigned to me. I was just part of the group of guys who were answering this question on the brigade staff. Basically, Admiral Mullen wanted to know why we were in the Korangal Valley. And the Korangal, many of your listeners may recognize, the Korangal is in Kunar province. It's on the Pakistan border. It's been described by the New York Times as the Valley of Death. It was on the cover of Time magazine. It's probably the most recognizable site of battle in Afghanistan for the American public. The Korangal is all of 15, 20 kilometers long, maybe. It's not very big. There's only about 10,000 people who live in it. And they speak their own language. So in the year 2009, you have a valley of people who speak their own language. So right off the bat, you're thinking, why do we have troops in there? We really should have probably anthropologists in there.
Mm-hmm.
So what had happened was we found that as early as late 2004 or so, we had sent American forces in there, and they really hadn't been engaged much, very little contact with the enemy. So we were wondering why, over the course of 4 years, did it go from just really two contacts with the enemy in 8 months to the Valley of Death. What we found was that we went in there, and then this is, like we said, this is a population of 10,000 people. Their only trade is the timber trade, and they've been doing that for generations, for probably hundreds of years. And when they engage in this, when they cut the trees down and move their lumber, they don't even, for the most part, we don't even think they really even leave the mouth of their valley. We think they go to their valley, or to the mouth of the valley, and a middleman picks it up, or they go to a pass someplace. These people are only concerned about their valley and have very little interest in the world outside of it. So what happens is we go in there, we end up garrisoning it. Then the Afghan National Army and Afghan National Police come in with us as well. They are not representative of the Korangalis. They're not representative of the region. They are outsiders. One of my beliefs and thesis behind how I feel about Afghanistan is that this is a civil war. This Afghan National Army and its Afghan National Police, they're representative of the other side of the civil war, the side that the Korangalis would not be on. And so what you basically have, you have people who are fighting us to get out of the valley. And that was the conclusion we came with, was that if we left the Korangal, the site of you know, literally dozens of American casualties, if we left the Korangal, nothing would happen. The Korangalis were not going to line up and march on Kabul next. They were just going to go about their business and be happy we weren't there.
So, in other words, this, for you, is kind of a microcosm of the whole situation?
Exactly. This is the first one I really researched and really saw clearly. Because for every, and here's, this, like I said, a microcosm, for every Korangal we're in, for all these valleys that we have, where our troops are engaged and our kids are fighting and dying, for every valley that we're in, there's like 100 that we're not. And it comes down to also an issue, too, an internal issue to Afghanistan, because what's behind this, I started talking about the timber trade, it really comes down to the issue of taxes. Really what happens now is that you have the Afghan central government going into the Korangal Valley and going into countless other valleys and saying, yeah, that those mountains that you're cutting your trees down on, that your family's been cutting trees down on for generations, they don't belong to you, they belong to the central government, and you don't have to pay tax on that in some form. And so you think, what are we doing involved in this? Why are our troops fighting and dying over something like
this? Right, we're riding.
It has nothing to do with our security or safety as a nation.
It sounds like we're riding shotgun on a tax collector.
That's a very good way to put it. I don't want to oversimplify it, but that's a very good way to put it.
So, in other words, the work you were doing with all the best intentions led you to this conclusion that you sort of stated before, that we are enmeshed in a civil war, and I don't think that most Americans know that. What is that civil war?
The civil war has been going on since 1973, since when the king was deposed. It's probably been going on for longer than that. But in terms of the violent aspect of it or how readily apparent it is, then it particularly picked up in 1977-78 with the Saur Revolution. Which then ultimately led to the Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan. But the Civil War, basically, as I see, it's a clash, for the most part, within Pashtun society, between the urban, the educated, the secular, the progressive, the modern, versus the rural, the poor, the religious, the traditional. And it's a very, very much a societal clash within that society, within Afghanistan. One of the ways it was described to me, interestingly, was from an Afghan National Army general, who was very proud of the fact that his province, Badakhshan province, was one of the first provinces to start the revolution in 77 or 78, as he said. And he said the reason why they started the revolution was because the government came to our villages and asked us what our wives' names were. And so really it's an intrusion on a traditional rural life that is resented, and that is really the spark that began the Civil War that has continued, throughout the 80s, throughout the 90s, and up until now. Most rural Afghans that you meet, the folks who are taking funding from the Taliban to fight us and who are fighting us because we're occupying them or the central government's occupying them, they really see no difference in the central government, whether it was the communist government, whether it was the post-communist government under Rabini, whether it was the Taliban government or the Karzai government. They see the central government really as one and the same, as an intrusion on their lives and on their way of life.
Okay. So you came to this decision to resign and wrote a four-page letter to your superiors. I think in our conversation so far, you've stated many of the reasons that end up in that letter. But if you want to summarize, again, what were the points that lead you to such a tough decision?
Sure. Like I said, we just spoke about the Korangal and then the realization that in the east, where our troops are engaged, that's the reason for most of the combat is that we are occupying a population. And then when I moved down to the south, I saw much of the same, and I really started to understand the Civil War aspect of it. The other part too is that this does not do anything to defeat Al Qaeda. I think most people Most folks in the intelligence community, most folks within diplomatic and military circles, agree that al-Qaeda is an organization that is only a few thousand strong and that exists in these small networked cells that don't require any type of political or state support for their success or for their operations. That al-Qaeda primarily exists really on the Internet, and that if we withdraw from Afghanistan, al-Qaeda is not going to rush back into Afghanistan because they don't need to. They already have as many failed states as they want to have operations in, and they don't require a landmass to conduct their operations. So that realization, too, that, you know, this is not doing anything to defeat al-Qaeda, that we've got 60,000 troops here, we've got families that are sacrificing really, really good and talented young men for something that's not going to make us safer. And then also, too, just the understanding as well that Pakistan should be our priority. Pakistan, because of its nuclear weapons and because of its relationship with India and because of its prominence in the region there, that should be our priority. And our presence in Afghanistan, I think a lot of people will agree, has only destabilized Pakistan these last 5, 6, 7, 8 years. So those are really the three key points that drove me to this decision. Nothing I write about in my letter is unique or novel to myself. I heard you reference Professor Pasevich earlier. I know he has been saying some of these things for many years now, as well as within military and diplomatic circles. I've received a lot of support, and a lot of these thoughts of mine that I wrote were things that I had discussed with people before, or people had discussed with me. So nothing I say is novel or unique, and it's certainly not. There was never any eureka moment in writing this. It was basically just a compilation of 5 months.
Right, and what I hear is that it wasn't that you were the first one to come up with this. It was just that it drove you to take this personal action. I'm Terrence McNally speaking with Matthew Ho. He's the former Marine Iraq War vet who recently resigned his role with the Foreign Service in Afghanistan, and we're speaking about how he came to that decision. And now what I'd like to ask you is if there's a way that I like to approach certain issues, and it's to say, if it's broke, let's fix it. And it's basically three questions, and we've got about 6 minutes.
Okay.
First question is, how do we know that our role in Afghanistan is broken?
I think it's you know, what we're doing there doesn't pass the common sense test. I think there's a general agreement that the people we are fighting us because we're occupying them, as well as an agreement among a lot of people that, al-Qaeda does not exist in a form that garrisoning troops in one country is going to defeat it. So I think there's a logic test that this fails to pass. And I think that's how we know that this is not working.
Very good. And how did it get broken? In other words, that is not how did the Afghanistan situation turn into what it is, but how did our engagement there get broken? What are the causes?
You know, I think most people agree that we lost focus on Afghanistan with the Iraq War, and I certainly don't want to get bogged down to the politics of that. Up until now, I've had tremendous bipartisan support on this issue, and I definitely would like to keep that. So,
well, I've noticed, by the way, just for listeners, I've noticed in reading other interviews you've had and so on, that you are very careful to say, let's not argue about the past. Let's deal with the situation we face.
Exactly. You know, and that's really a personal, emotional thing for me because we have kids out there. I mean, some mother probably just lost her son today, or some wife just probably lost her husband today in Afghanistan, or maybe multiple people did. So to squabble about petty partisan politics from 2004, 2005, 2006, really is a disservice to those brave young men out there. And we need to move forward. We need to analyze where we're at right now and go forward. But, you know, I think a lot of our involvement in Afghanistan, the need to be there, within domestic concerns, it comes down to a fear of another 9/11, which is a well-justified fear because we as a nation, we cannot have an attack like that ever again. Just for our economy's sake, an attack like that right now would be terrible for us. And so al-Qaeda needs to be our primary threat. How we lost focus on that, I'm not sure how we got into this point where we're just continue to march lockstep forward doing the same thing over and over again in Afghanistan, one year after the next. Well, hey, it hasn't been working, so let's just double our forces and be able to work again. I'm not sure why we have that think, why there's that group think, why there's that mentality, but it exists and it needs to change. And we need to recognize that the threat's Al-Qaeda, the priority should be Pakistan, and that having these troops, our troops there, 60,000 troops or maybe up to 100,000 troops, will not defeat Al-Qaeda and will not stabilize Pakistan.
Okay. Finally, the how do we fix it? What are the solutions? And I have a feeling I'm asking you two questions in that. One is basically what you were just alluding to, is that what do you think is the would be best for the U.S. in Afghanistan? The second might be what should listeners do if they agree with that?
Sure. Okay, thanks. What I would my recommendation is this: stop fighting the people who are fighting us only because we're occupying them or because the central government is occupying them. Recognize that it's a civil war and that civil wars only end through political reconciliation. They can also end by one side decimating the other or just both sides tiring of the fighting and segregating themselves from one another. Neither one of those are good courses of action for us or for the world community or for the people of Afghanistan. So we need to recognize that it's a civil war, and we need to really, really push hard for political reconciliation. I don't believe the Karzai administration has any interest whatsoever in reconciliation. They've not done any of it in the last 8 years, and I don't believe they will do any reconciliation attempts in the next several years. Like I said, stop combat operations in those valleys and villages where people are fighting us, where our presence only fuels the insurgency, where it only legitimizes our enemy's claims as well as the claims and justifies Al-Qaeda's existence. We need to look at re-engaging, or not re-engaging, but doubling our efforts with Pakistan. And I'm not a Pakistan expert, so I don't know if that means go really hard on Pakistan or go real easy, give them everything they need with no strings attached or lean real heavily on them. I'm not sure which way to go on that, but that needs to be our focus.
That should be the conversation that we're having 6 months from now, a year from now, rather than this one. But let me ask, when you say reconciliation, that's reconciliation between whom?
Between the various factions within Afghanistan. And you got to be very careful because we don't want Afghanistan to return to a state of warlordism. But we also can't have a country where the vast majority of the rural population is distanced or not included in the government. So you're going to have to bring in members of the Taliban into the government. And that in order to get true reconciliation, in order to get an Afghanistan that is not a failed state, you are going to need to have members of the Taliban in the Afghanistan government.
Okay, so that sounds like an enormous challenge. And that second part of that question, which I ask, is what should listeners do? We've gotten to the point where we've got to end this interview, but I would just say basically learn as much as you can. Look at rethinkafghanistan.com for a lot of information. Google Matthew Ho, and you can see other things he has said. And then just make sure that you are keeping your representatives informed of your feelings. I've been speaking with Matthew Ho. He's the former Marine Iraq War vet. He recently resigned his role with the Foreign Service in Afghanistan because he couldn't participate in the continued occupation. I recommend you look him up, as I said, on Google. Read that letter of resignation. Thank you, Matthew Ho, and continue to keep up your good work.
Thank you, Terrence.
We'll be back with Malala Joya, the author of A Woman Among Warlords. This is Terrence McNally. In the second half, you'll hear my 2009 conversation with Malala Joya, the youngest member elected to the Afghan parliament in 2005, who was expelled in 2007, as she says, for raising her voice and condemning warlords. A lot of folks think we've got to stay militarily involved in Afghanistan because we broke it, and thus we bought it. Some say we've got to stay for the good of the Afghan women. But who is our partner over there? Who is our ally? Malala Joya seems an ideal person to talk to at this time. She was born in Afghanistan's remote Farah province, grew up in refugee camps in Iran and Pakistan, and is the youngest person ever elected to the Afghan parliament. Joya was suspended in 2007 for her denunciation of warlords in government. Since then, she has survived 5 assassination attempts and travels in Afghanistan under a burqa and with armed guard. She was named one of the World Economic Forum's 250 Young Global Leaders, nominated for the European Parliament's Sakharov Prize for Freedom of Thought, both in 2007. She's the subject of the documentary Enemies of Happiness, which won the World Cinema Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival and the International Human Rights Film Award at the Berlin International Film Festival. Malala Joya wrote a new book, and that's What brings her to this country? A Woman Among Warlords, the extraordinary story of an Afghan who dared to raise her voice. And these are her words, quote, "Never again will I whisper in the shadows of intimidation. I am but a symbol of my people's struggle and a servant to their cause. And if I were to be killed for what I believe in, then let my blood be the beacon for emancipation and my words a revolutionary paradigm for generations to come." According to the official story, someone like Malala Joya is who we've been fighting for. But she says, dust has been thrown into the eyes of the world by your governments. You have not been told the truth. The situation now is as catastrophic as it was under the Taliban for women. Your governments have replaced the fundamentalist rule of the Taliban with another fundamentalist regime of warlords. That is what your soldiers are dying for. Welcome, Malala Joya, to KPFK and Free Forum.
Thank you. Thanks for this interview.
Okay. I like people to get a sense of the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So what was your life prior to your run for parliament?
Yeah, my life has been changed after my speech in 2003, that first time I became elected, when we made the constitution, as the situation was quite non-democratic in the Lojirga because most of the representative was not real representative, and they were warlords, drug lords, and these criminals who did civil war in Afghanistan from 92 to 96. And after 9/11, with the mask of democracy, they came in power. So few Democrat men and women was here in the Lojirga 2003. And I was one of those who stand up against them and expose their mask. As you can read some memory of that in my book, as well, that how it was difficult to give me chance. Anyway, then I said, on behalf of one generation, if you give me chance, on behalf of a young generation especially, then it was interesting for the chairman, a warlord man of the Lojirga.
So what you were saying was that if you give me chance, that was what you said to the people when you were running?
Or is that what you said in the parliament? No, in the Lojirga 2003. But in the parliament that I found way for the second time, there also that because every one of these warlords know about me, and more than 80% seats of the parliament belongs to warlords, drug lords, criminals. Even one member of the parliament is Talib, and they were in power, they did cheating, they spent guns, they spent lots of dollars, they had foreign supports, and they controlled Afghanistan.
The original Lojirga was prior to the creation of parliament. It was the gathering of representatives from around the country before there was a parliament, correct?
No, there was two elections, that do not be misunderstanding.
Good.
First election, we made constitution, was Lojirga, called Lojirga, that there representative around Afghanistan, men and women, but most of them was not real representative. But the second election was parliamentary election, that we had constitution, but now this is the time to put the law in practice.
And when you ran for parliament for the second representative entity, you were already known as an outspoken.
Yeah, because I became famous in 2003, as now I said earlier, that I stand up against them and I expose their mask for the great people around the world, not only my people, that they know about them.
And that moment when you stood up and exposed them, that really changed your life. Tell us a little bit, because I want people to get a sense of that. How old were you at the time?
On that time, I was 25 years old.
25 years old and a woman. And you sit in this room where you see many warlords, you see people who are not actual representatives.
Yeah.
And what went on inside of you before you spoke, and then tell the people who don't know what you said that day?
Yeah, you know, as I was a social activist, I became woman rights, human rights activist when I was in refugee camps in Pakistan in high school. In the morning, I was a student. In the evening, I became teacher. And I had close contact with my Afghan, millions of Afghan who lived in refugee camps, different refugee camps in Pakistan, that even some journalists put the name of these camps, foreign journalists who came there, living graveyard. I cried a lot with people. I laughed with them. I know about their suffer story. But in in 2098, when I finished school on behalf of OPAC, Organization of Promoting Afghan Women Capabilities, it was like NGO, but even was not registered. We moved to Herat province together with my family.
So let me just slow you down for a second. So what you're saying is that in 98, you finished your schooling.
Yeah.
And you got involved with an NGO.
Yeah. They know me as activist in this camp, and they asked me, and they said, if you work with us, we appreciate, because our activities for women and children, because there is no education in the period of Taliban. And for me, it was important that, because same my age, the girls and women and younger than me and older, there was no education for them in the period of Taliban.
And is that one of the reasons that you were in a refugee camp in Pakistan, in any case, was so that you could get an education?
Yeah. When I finished education, that as I said, even on that time, I had close contact with my people. But then in the period of Taliban, then after that as well, until 2003, as close contact with people I had. But first time when I went in Lojirga 2003, for the first time in my life, I saw the faces of these criminals in person.
I can imagine. So in other words, what you're saying is, until then, you knew the power they had. You knew what they had done to your country. Suddenly, you are in a room, and there they are.
Yeah, and you are looking to them that how they shamelessly pretend themselves as a Democrat with bloody hands, and how much they killed my people, as 60, more than 65,000 innocent people in Kabul they killed. They did civil war in Afghanistan from 92 to 96.
Now, that before we get back to what you're going to say that day, this civil war from 92 to 96, who are the sides?
You know, these warlords, as we divide our people, Mujahideen, that freedom-loving fighter, when all together fight it against Russia occupation, we call them Mujahideen. But when Russia failed in Afghanistan, in puppet of Russia, we call them Khalkin Parchamin. They're also killer, a bunch of killer.
So in the war against the Soviets, the Mujahideen, these Afghans and folks from outside of Afghanistan, yes, come together.
Since Cold War, they got lots of money and gun from CIA and ISI and Iran, fascist regime of Iran and Saudi Arabistan, etc. So they were not real Mujahideen, but my people didn't know them. Why? Because all together fight it against occupation.
Right.
But after that, when Russia fell...
Once the Soviet Union is out, then...
Then all people put the gun on the earth. Then they said, this is the time to build our country, because occupation forces failed in Afghanistan.
We've won, so now we can rebuild our country.
But on that time, they showed their real nature, their criminal faces, to my people. As every one of these eight fundamentalist parties that since Cold War had, they were puppet, and they on that time, everyone want to be a president. And they, first of all, destroyed our national unity. Everyone want to come in power and belongs to different ethnics, like Hazara, Pashtun, Tajik, Uzbek. And then they not only destroyed national unity, they did many crimes against human rights and women rights.
This is the civil war following the exit of the Soviets. So I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Malala Joya. She's the author of A Woman Among Warlords, the extraordinary story of an Afghan who dared to raise her voice. You can learn more at her website, malalajoya.com. I'm going to spell that for you. MALAIJOYA, MalalaiJoya, oneword.com. So the Civil War is in that period between the end of the Soviets and 9/11. And what happens in there, it's, you're saying, former Mujahideen, where does the Taliban fit in? Where do they come into this?
You know that when these fundamentalist Mujahideen, not real Mujahideen, as I divided Mujahideen to two parts, even in the parliament, these warlords, these criminal Mujahideen beat at me. Even they threatened me to rape, because I said this truth.
They threatened to rape you in the parliament.
Yeah, when I divided parliamentarian Mujahideen to two parts, which is right, and my people
agree.
And
the two parts of the Mujahideen you see are?
Yeah, most of them are freedom-loving fighters against occupation. They are real Mujahideen. Criminal Mujahideen, a bunch of killers that like Rabbani, Kanuni, Dostum, Ismail Khan, Fahim, Sayaf.
You're not afraid to name names.
Of course that I never afraid. And I always am saying I don't fear that. I fear political silence. stands against injustice. And they are in power. They are Pinochet, Franco, Suharto, Mussolini, and Bushes of my country. With suit and tie, they are in power. Anyway, but...
So at the Loya Jirga, you see them face to face. You see them sitting there mocking democracy, and you stand up.
Yeah, that's why I couldn't tolerate that, how to sit silence. As always, I'm saying that for a second, if I get silence, I said to my people, think that this is like my political death. And
death.
Death, yeah.
Yeah, in other words, if you are silent, you are as good as dead.
Yeah, and that's why I said the truth, because it's still the first casualty is the truth. I teared their mask, and on behalf of my people, I said, these criminals who control Loya Jirga and with the mask of democracy, and after 9/11 they come in power, they must be powerless, and they must be brought to the national and international criminal court. But they in power, and they couldn't tolerate, because I exposed their mask for the Democrat justice-loving people around the world.
Very good. So in this moment, in this, as you say, sort of a mockery of democracy because of who is there, you, at the time, 25-year-old woman, get up, say this speech. What happens then?
Yeah, it was briefly that I said about this speech. They gave me
a minute and a half or something, yes?
And less than 2 minutes, they couldn't tolerate. And my life has been changed. You can see on some clip there as well, that on my website, and also even a filmmaker came from Danish filmmaker, the documentary Enemies of Happiness that they made. And there also you can see. Anyway, but word after that understood them. And they physically want to beat me. And even some fundamentalist woman, very bad word they used to me. Same like in the parliament, one fundamentalist woman told me, if you do not sit silence, I will do something against you that no man dare to do. And then I just said, you are a victim. And these kind of women, I think they are the victim, and they are not real representative. Most of them right now in power in the parliament, and they have just symbolic role, peace show. Because under the banner of women rights, human rights, they occupied my country, US and NATO. And it's still playing with the destiny of my people. Yeah.
So let me just, so that happens in Loya Jirga. Then you are later, 2 years later, elected to parliament. Yes?
Yeah, but this election was quite non-democratic election as well. But because I was very famous also for the, not only for my people, for Democrat people around the world. And if they do not allow me to come to the parliament, as all the boxes was in the hands of mafia, but their cheating was clear for the world.
So in other words, if they hadn't allowed you to win, if they hadn't counted your votes accurately, it would have been obvious.
Yeah, as they did, because everyone said, even Sky and Earth of Pharaoh people, in Pharaoh people, all of them also, that I will be the first winner, because everyone saw the strong solidarity of these innocent Safar people, not only in Pharaoh, around Afghanistan.
And Pharaoh is the province.
Yeah, that I become elected. But the only thing...
It's a rural province with a small population, yes?
Yeah, but close to Herat, and on that time, the only things that they did, they made me second winner. They do not allow me to be their first winner. They showed their power.
Right, right. But they did seat you. Mm. You were banned from parliament in 2007 for what?
Yeah, in the beginning of parliament, they couldn't tolerate me. They turned off microphone, they beat at me, and they threatened me to rape, and etc. But because they couldn't make me silence, and I exposed their crimes in their own house, in the national house, so I divided a parliamentarian to two parts. First part, I said most of members of the parliament, more than 80%, are warlords, drug lords, criminals.
And 80% part, warlords, drug lords, criminals.
Yeah. And the second part, that some Democrat men and women, real representative, that even you can count them. I said they are Democrat. Then they did censor the first part about Democrat, only second part about these criminals, that I compared some of their crimes with some animals. And I said, it's worse than animal stable. It's like zoo. They are wild criminals that walking with two legs, but they are worse than some wild animal even. Some wild animal will eat some animal, another innocent animal, then for a while getting silenced because getting full. But they are not getting full still. They are killing more the people, shed the blood of the people, kill more innocent women, and continue to their crimes.
And for that, they said that you were insulting other members of the parliament, and for that you should be banned.
Yeah, they told me that I must say apologize, which was quite illegal, like that they banned me. Then I said apologize to some useful animal that I compared, and I mastered that. No need for telling the truth to say apologize, and also to these criminals, to these misogynists. Let me tell you a few examples why I compared with wild animals. Not only the crimes in the past they committed, also civil war they did. Right now that they are in power, they are not lawmakers, they are lawbreakers. One member of parliament, his name is Haji Painda. He has son with two other warlords, raped three women, three men, three warlords, one of them son of the member of the parliament, raped 14-year-old girl. Her name is Bashira in Saripur province.
And this is known.
And this is known. And also, this Haji Painda changed the age of his son less than 18 that do not be punished. Another member of parliament, his name is Piram Kol. And Piram Kol killed two innocent child. One is 6 years old, one is 7 years old. Two in the pocket, which made by clothes. Two in the river. And when people find the dead body of these two children in Rostock district of Tachar province in the north of Afghanistan, they had huge demonstration. Nobody listened their voice, and this cruel man enjoying in the parliament. Another member of the parliament.
Okay.
Many examples now doing crime, not only in the
That's
past.
That's right. So you're saying that these people are committing crimes right now, and you're saying rather than serving in parliament, they should be put on trial.
Of course. They are not lawmakers. They are lawbreakers. We have jungle law in Afghanistan.
So, again, I'm Terrence McNally. The voice you hear is Malala Joya. She is the youngest person elected to parliament in Afghanistan at the age of 25. She has been banned from parliament for raising her voice, for telling the truth about some of the other members of parliament, who she says are not lawmakers but lawbreakers. She has a book out called A Woman Among Warriors, The Extraordinary Story of an Afghan Who Dared to Raise Her Voice. And you can learn more about her work and her life at MalalaJoya.com. Let's, because we are short on time, pull up to the present. The present. You are banned from parliament, yet you return to Afghanistan. Your life is threatened. You when you're in Afghanistan, you wear the full burqa, you have armed guards and so on. What the American people and my listeners probably want to know is, as I said at the top, the reason that we are told we are there, the reason that we should maybe send more troops is because two things. One, what will happen if we leave? And two, for the good of the women. So first, the argument for the good of the women, that's why the U.S. and NATO should continue to occupy and fight. Yes or no?
They occupied my country, which is so clear. As soon as possible, they must leave Afghanistan, because they pushed us from the frying pan to the fire after 9/11. And still they are sending their taxpayer money to such a mafia corrupt system, and also still supporting these warlords and now negotiating with Taliban. They don't want to stop arming the warlords. They don't want to support democratic-minded, justice-loving people of my country, while we have a lot like your country. If after 9/11 they give chance to these democratic-minded people of my country, two times Afghanistan was rebelled.
Okay, let's deal with
no
that.
Need to most any troops in Afghanistan.
Most people in America do not know that there is a democratic alternative. They are told that the democratic alternative is Karzai, right? Who are these Democrats? What is this alternative? If we left, who would be there to oppose the warlords?
You know, as I come from Afghanistan, we are on the fire. We are from sandwich squashed between two powerful enemies from the sky, occupation forces bombing, killing civilians. Civilians, most of them women and children. In the ground, Taliban and warlords together continue to their fascism. So Karzai, this shameless puppet man, did compromise with these criminals, and still he is doing, and now invite Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and Mullah Omar as well.
Whoop,
to join
too
the
fast,
government.
Too fast.
Yeah.
What did you just say?
I said
you said Karzai is a puppet.
Yeah,
but
he right now, this 8 years, he did compromise with the warlords.
For eight years he's compromised with the warlords.
And still, he do compromise and even invite Mullah Omar, the terrorist, and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, this fascist man, as well, to join the government.
That's right. So he has actually brought in additional warlords as his running mates.
Yeah. So situation will be more disastrous, especially for the women. And you said under the banner of women rights, that as I said, they come in Afghanistan. Later I will give you about women rights. But you say if these troops leave Afghanistan, what will happen? Today itself is like civil war. By presence of thousands of troops in Afghanistan, first, we do not have security, which is more important than food and water.
Wait a minute. One would, the Americans, those who favor American military over there will say that our military provides security.
How they provide security? That your government say we build some schools there while there is no security. The girls go to school, they throw acids on their faces. What happened in Kandahar? Media in Afghanistan give report. Hundreds of girls become poisons. By presence of thousands of troops, suicide attack, also rape cases, domestic violences, killing of women increasing rapidly.
Well, but wait. You're saying that the presence of our troops does not help security?
Of course not. You saw even in Kabul a few days before, UN office has been attacked. Serena Hotel, the safest place of Kabul, has been attacked. In around Afghanistan, the government has no control, and also situation for millions of Afghans like hell.
Now, one of the things they're saying is maybe we'll do a policy where we work in the cities and we let the rural area be what it wants. What do you think of that?
Sorry, maybe I misunderstood.
Oh, some people say we should change our policy so that we put our troops in the urban areas and we just provide security in the urban areas and let the rural areas do whatever they want.
You know, in the faraway provinces and this area that you mentioned, there is security even worse. You know, there also we do not have security. Today, millions of Afghans, by presence of thousands of troops, they suffer from injustice, insecurity, corruption, joblessness, poverty. And this 8 years is enough that U.S. government know that their policy is quite wrong policy. And if really Mr. Obama honest for Afghan people, there are some other alternative first.
Okay, the alternatives.
First, the alternative first. In this occupation, which is not war on terror, war on innocent civilians. Secondly, stop arming the warlords and not negotiate with Taliban. The main alternative, the third one, support the democratic-minded, justice-loving people of my country.
And who are they?
We have a lot, not only Ahmad and Mahmoud to tell you the name to you, like your country. Still, there are underground activists. Some democratic parties we have, more than parties intellectuals, but because of security. Who guarantee their security if I mention their name? While we have a lot, at least one of them, like Rawa organization, their activist was there. They are famous.
Hambastagi Party. Rawa is one group you're mentioning.
One group is Rawa. Another
RAWA.org.
Yeah. Hambastagi Party is this Hambastagi Wise Party. This even their leader told me, Malala, we are not able to publish our magazine. Still, they are underground activists because of lack of money.
So let me just a sec. So the democratic folks you say are underground because of the situation. And you feel that if the U.S. and NATO withdraw their troops, that these democratic folks will emerge?
Of course, they are active now. They will be more active. But not only these democratic people, with the support of the ordinary people, millions of these innocent, suffered people of Afghanistan, they are nothing. But they support them. But if U.S. and its allies a little bit, let us Britain peace. They occupied my country. They killed civilians. You know, my life story is an example on behalf of those Democrat and also ordinary people of my country. When you compare my life as a Democrat activist with the dark period of Taliban, on that time it was risky. We wear this disgusting burqa, which is symbol of oppression. Always I'm saying it's like shot for life, buddy. But now, even with burqa and bodyguard not safe, this disgusting burqa now gives lives to the woman. Still underground activists, many assassination attempts, many other activists, brave activists, Democrat, they called women like Zakia Zaki, Malala Kakar, Sitara Achikzai, Nadia Anjuman, etc. And still they continue to do a fascism not only against Democrat, also innocent people of
the country. So you have hope that if the NATO and U.S. withdraw, that the people of Afghanistan, the democratic people of Afghanistan, will rise up against the Taliban and against the warlords and against Karzai?
Of course, still they do struggle. Karzai's regime is an example how much it is weak. And political knowledge of my people is a big hope for the future of Afghanistan. We almost lost everything. We gained one positive thing. This political consciousness of my people and resistance of my people, that day by day they stand up against occupation, against warlords. They do demonstration, but mainstream media never showed their demonstrations. And also that we have proudful history. We have lots of hopes. British want to occupy Afghanistan. They felt Russia as a superpower country want to occupy Afghanistan, faced with resistance of my people. If voluntarily they do not leave Afghanistan, they will face with resistance of my people. Let me tell you that. You know, U.S. government now in Afghanistan, $100 million a day they use for war, while the total aid for the reconstruction of Afghanistan a day is $7 million. And most of these money...
Okay, let me repeat that number. You're saying that we spend $100 million a day on war and $7 million...
Dollar a day for total reconstruction.
For reconstruction.
But most of this money went into pocket of the warlords, drug lords, injured lords, and these are now negotiating with Taliban. Only this point is enough for justice-loving people of the U.S. This 8 years, they changed Afghanistan to the center of drug. Medieval-minded Taliban.
What she just said is that in the 8 years since our invasion and occupation, Afghanistan is now the center of the opium trade in the world.
The center of the drug and safe haven for terrorism. This is not democracy. Democracy meaning is government of people for people. But enemies of democracy in power and shamelessly U.S. government and NATO pretend themselves to the great people of the world that we are bringing democracy in Afghanistan, which is impossible.
Finally, if I give you one more minute, what would you say to listeners? What should they do? What should they try to do to help the people of Afghanistan?
Of course, my message to them is that no nation can donate liberation to another nation. But
let me just repeat
question.
That in case they didn't get it. No nation can donate liberation to another nation.
Yeah. And my message is that please educationally support my people, democratic-minded people, through them, innocent people of my country, because education is a key toward emancipation. And my message to them is that injustice anywhere is the start of justice everywhere. Please raise your voice against the wrong policy, war crime of your government. As a justice-loving, democratic-minded, peace-loving people of U.S. and around the world, because always nations, peoples are separate from the wrong policymakers. As always, I'm saying silence of good people is worse than the action of bad people. Don't forget us.
Okay, the book is A Woman Among Warlords, the extraordinary story of an Afghan who dared to raise her voice. The website is malalaijoya.com, M-A-L-A-L-A-I, Joya, J-O-Y-A, one word, malalaijoya.com. Thank you, Malala Joya.
Okay.
Keep up your good work.
Thank you. Thanks for your support.
Hi, I'm Laura Flanders of The Laura Flanders Show, where I interview the best thinkers and doers of our time. On TV, the show premieres Sundays at 11:30 Eastern on PBS World and at The Laura Flanders Show YouTube channel. You can join my guests and me every week there in the live viewing party, and then catch us all week on public television stations. Prefer to listen? Find us on a radio station near you or subscribe to the free podcast. You'll find listings and ways to subscribe at LauraFlanders.org. That's also where you'll receive my regular commentaries. I call them the F word. Here's this week's. Non-invasive, not-for-profit, and did I mention free? If ever there was a time to invest in American public media, surely this is that time. The COVID-19 pandemic's proved there's a lot to be said for public services, like public libraries, the post office, public hospitals, and public schools. They may not be perfect, but they were there when we needed them. And for millions of Americans unable to access quality streaming internet or school, public television was there for them and their kids when they were stuck at home. Don't get me wrong, family-owned newsrooms, especially local ones, have long needed help. Give them a stimulus, tax credits for subscribers, a new journalist jobs program, add nonprofit reporters, especially women and reporters of color, to AmeriCorps. Forgive their student loans. Congress is looking at bills to do all of the above and more. But when it comes to nonprofit public media, our system needs more than a bailout. Public media needs Americans to buy in for the very first time. While every other wealthy nation spends around $100 per head for public media of different kinds, the U.S. government spends just over $1, and leaving journalism to the markets worked as well as leaving healthcare there. You can complain all you like about spies and snake oil salesmen messing with the news and your neighbor's heads, but the best alternative to profit and power-driven media is a system paid for and dedicated to the public, to serve the public interest. We haven't seen a major commitment in that since the days of LBJ and before that FDR. So while people are talking about new deals for a better future and investments in clean air and water and other public goods, how about a new deal for democracy by way of a real investment in public media and not-for-profit news? We're not talking the Politburo. We're talking PBS, or what PBS and public radio would be like if the systems and the independent public producers who contribute to them, like us, didn't have to go begging for every dime. Let's build back different and build our democracy different by having a deep investment in public media institutions and the means to keep them that way. Thanks for listening. I'm Laura. You can find my conversation with a new BIPOC-led network of local news media outlets and my conversation with the new Chief of General Programming at Public Television at lauraflanders.org. And subscribe there to this podcast for all our audio extras, commentaries, and more. Don't forget to contribute. Thanks.